This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 30th of May 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we're joined by Ben Judah to get the day's news agenda from a Russian perspective. What have you got for us, Ben?
We're going to be talking about the flight of Russia's most famous economist and what this means for an already frightened investment class, Putin's escalating proxy war in the Middle East, and crashing Russian growth expectations from the OECD and what that means for stability.
Also, it's time for us to talk a bit of art. We head to the Venice Biennale for a sneak peek of what you can expect at this year's fair.
It seems like a day hasn't gone by without more bad news for Berlin's new Brandenburg Airport. But is the horizon looking brighter, or we still see a bumpy ride?
It's one of the most rapidly developing cities on the planet, and there's a real tension between the old and the new. We head to Shanghai to find out how much things have changed in their traditional lane houses.
Everybody know each others. How many person in your family, what they do. If their daughter is very old age, not yet get married, they ask other people to help.
All that, plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy 60 minutes ahead, but before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest world news headlines.
There's been an angry reaction from the relatives of Afghans killed by an American soldier to the news that he has struck a deal to avoid the death penalty. Robert Bales will plead guilty over the deaths of 16 civilians killed in attacks on two compounds in Kandahar province last month. A military court hearing in a month's time could still sentence Bales to life in prison with no possibility of parole. The U.S. State Department is warning Hezbollah to get its fighters out of Syria, amid reports thousands are fighting against rebel forces in the country. It's estimated up to 7,000 have travelled from Lebanon. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says it's a big concern, and he's also criticised moves by other countries to provide arms, both to rebels and government forces.
There is no shortage of arms in both sides. Providing arms to either side will not help this process. There is no such military solution in this case. I think only a political process can resolve this issue sustainable way.
A man has been charged with the murder of a British soldier who was killed on a street in London last week. Michael Adebowale is due before a court in the city later, accused of killing Lee Rigby. A second suspect remains under police guard in hospital, more than a week after the attack in which the soldier died. Health officials are warning the novel coronavirus is now a threat to the entire world. Although there have been fewer than 50 confirmed human cases so far, more than half have been fatal. The virus comes from the same family as SARS. Dr. Margaret Chan, who's the head of the World Health Organization, says the danger must be taken seriously.
We understand too little. Too little about this virus when viewed against the magnitude of its potential threat. The novel coronavirus is not a problem that any single affected country can keep to itself or manage all by itself. The novel coronavirus is a threat to the entire world.
New York's mayor has said he will not end his campaign for tougher gun control laws after police confirmed ricin was present in two letters sent to him. Poison is 1,000 times more toxic than cyanide. Michael Bloomberg says the letters attacked his gun control campaign. A prosecutor in Argentina has accused Iran of seeking to sponsor terrorist activity in Latin America. Alberto Nisman says that Iran attempted to set up intelligence gathering operations in Brazil, Chile and Colombia. He is investigating a bomb attack in Buenos Aires which killed 85 people. Iran has always denied any involvement in the bombing of a Jewish center in the city. The US Vice President Joe Biden has started a three-day visit to Brazil. He's there to meet government officials and business leaders. Today, Mr. Biden's due to visit a slum in Rio before flying to Brasilia.
You have emerged and everybody's noticed. You've emerged and you've engaged on food security, non-proliferation, peacekeeping, conflict prevention, anti-corruption efforts. You've emerged and you've engaged and you've had a positive impact on the world.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul Osborne. Well, it's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Mordori House on Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midoriya House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today is Ben Judah, a research fellow at the European Stability Initiative and author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome to the show. Ben, let's begin with this startling story about a prominent economist you actually know who's just fled Russia.
Yes, well, firstly, thank you for having me. And over the past few months, like, the main story in Russia has been Putin's crackdown, about how slowly Putin has been picking off dissenters and those in the opposition or in the establishment that have, he believes, have been challenging his grip on power. And yesterday, the news broke that Russia's most famous economist, Sergei Guriev, had fled the country under heavy political pressure and amid accusations from officials that he might be brought in for questioning over the Yukos scandal, which was the affair which the oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky was jailed for. And this, I can't stress how important this is in Russia. Mr. Guriev, any serious investor, any serious analyst knows this man, because at all of the big investment forums, he was there giving you the briefing on the Russian economy. He was there telling you that Russian growth was going up. And for him to pack his bags and flee Russia, it's the equivalent of the German government banning Paul Krugman from entering Europe because of anti-austerity policies. It's the equivalent of the main sort of, in a sense, the main salesman for Putin's economic boom, kind of quietly and confidently encouraging people to put their money in Russia, suddenly being in Paris, never going to return.
It's very interesting that he's actually chosen to flee quite so quickly after being questioned by the police. But I wonder what this means for Russia, really. What will the reaction be to this? Because it could have some serious economic effects on the economy.
Well, Moscow's a small village. It's a village of oligarchs and analysts and bankers and diplomats. And in that village, this has been met with shock. Amongst those chattering classes, Mr. Guriev was always somebody in the establishment, known to support the opposition. And it was believed that somebody that well connected, that brilliant, that important for Russia's growth and future, would never be targeted. And it's caused a lot of questioning of what does this mean? How repressive has Russia come that this kind of event can happen? Also amongst investors in London, in New York, this has been met with a lot of shock. So yesterday, lots of big fund managers in London were calling each other up going, what does it mean? What's this crackdown? We haven't been following this. Suddenly, this man that they all know is not coming back to the country.
We should say there are so many entrepreneurs and businessmen in jail now in Russia. They're even discussing an amnesty just because it's crippling on the economy to have so many people locked away who are just indispensable.
Well, exactly. And this is one of the... That's a slightly different theme in some ways, because what's happened in Russia over the past 10 years is that first Putin stabilised the system, but Putin's bad bureaucracy meant that all of his officials became increasingly predatory. So lots of those entrepreneurs are jailed because local tax officials or local investigators right across the country are out of control. This is a decision that kind of came from the top to put pressure on Mr. Guriev. So this is like slightly different from the kind of cannibal the cannibal customs of kind of Russian tax officials in the provinces.
And Gurev is a strong supporter of Alexei Navalny, who's on trial right now, a leading opposition figure. Do you foresee this as the beginning of a mass exodus of some of Russia's brightest and most talented individuals?
In some ways, that's already happened. In the past 3 weeks, Russia's most infamous journalistic voice, Oleg Kashin, who narrowly survived being beaten to death by an unknown assailant several years ago, has left the country to Switzerland. And this is a big shot because Mr. Kashin was the voice of a generation, you could say, to a lot of young Russians, you know, proud of their country, but concerned about the Putin regime. One of Moscow's most popular radio hosts, Tonya Samsonova, has left the country for London in the past few weeks. So yes, in short.
Ben, let's move on to another topic, the OECD growth forecast. It's some bad news for much of Europe. What's the impact on Russia?
Well, the OECD has been downgrading Russia's growth forecast for a long time, and we're moving into a post-BRIC trajectory for Russian growth for the foreseeable future. In the 2000s, we saw Russia, you know, really keeping pace with China, growing at 7% a year, 8% a year. And this was the basis of Putin's legitimacy. You know, Putin may have been authoritarian, but in every city in Russia, you had new supermarkets, restaurants, and new shopping malls opening up. The OECD is predicting that now Russia's growth will be cut down to about 3%, though it's kind of unclear how reliable we should take these statistics to be. But this is not the same kind of social contract. It's not light touch authoritarianism with big growth. It's heavy authoritarianism with kind of, for an emerging market, not great growth.
And another story that really is dominating the headlines still, of course, is Syria. The EU lifting its arms embargo 2 days ago. Russia announcing yesterday that it was actually going to send anti-aircraft equipment to the Syrian government. Is this a game changer?
This is escalation, and what we have now in Syria is the most serious proxy war between Russia and the West, perhaps for 25 years. With the EU lifting its arms embargo and with Russia continuing to ship arms and support the Assad regime, we're moving into a territory of very, very bloody stalemate, of which neither force is likely to weaken and neither force is likely to be able to prevail over the others. From Russia's point of view, this is very logical, and they're willing to put as much effort and as much arms on the ground as it will take not to allow the West to intervene unilaterally in Syria, which they believe would be moving one of the pieces in the Middle East before the final assault on Iran.
I wonder, some very tough rhetoric coming from Sergei Lavrov, calling the decision not to renew the arms embargo as unilateral and odious. But I wonder what you think their motivation really is in Syria. Everyone talks about the port of Tartus and how strategic that is for Russia. Do you think that's really the root of their support, or is it something else?
Well, the root of most things in Russia is actually natural gas. And Russia's power and state coffers are financed off being the monopoly supplier of gas to Europe. But during the financial crisis, Russia's share of Europe's gas market has gone down from about 50% to about 40%. And this is because Qatar, the key backer of the rebels, has been nibbling away at Russia's gas monopoly through LNG. And what Russia is frightened of is that if Qatar and the West can create a new client state in Syria, all this terrain will be opened up so Qatar can build a gas pipeline to Turkey and thus to Europe, breaking Gazprom's monopoly. So it's in Russia's interest that Syria either stays its ally or in a state of civil war, so there can be no pipelines.
So Ben, what's your prediction of how this will be resolved? What will it take for Russia to back down?
I don't think Russia's going to back down. I think from the Russian perspective, the West needs to realise that it won't get something for nothing. What Russian diplomats believe is that in Serbia, Kosovo, Libya, Afghanistan, Western diplomats turn up and go, could you please leave and we'll give you nothing in return? And the West isn't actually making Russia an offer in Syria. The West is simply asking for Russia to discontinue its support for Assad. So we have to ask ourselves what kind of deal we would be willing to offer Putin in exchange for stopping arms shipments. It's definitely not the EU lifting its own arms embargo.
Well, Ben, thank you very much. Interesting analysis. That was Ben Judah, research fellow at the European Stability Initiative and author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin.
Coming up, we get a sneak peek of the Venice Biennale.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the global pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove. The time is 9:16 if you're in Copenhagen, rather. It's 8:16 here in London. Now, it is a global event that happens only twice a year. So each time the Venice Biennale opens its doors along the canals, it's a special event. On Saturday, the 55th annual Biennale will once again see hundreds of thousands of visitors head to the world's largest non-commercial art event.
This year, we'll see 88 different countries with exhibitions set across the city, along with 150 artists taking place. The curator of this year's Biennale, Massimiliano Giunto, themed the event around the Encyclopedic Palace. Well, joined on the line from Venice is Anna Summers-Cox from the art newspaper. Anna, welcome to Midori House.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Well, tell us what the talk of the town is. You've really been in Venice for a couple of days, and I wondered really what's captivating really the critics today.
I think everybody's extremely happy with Massimiliano Gioni's main exhibition. The thing about the Biennale is everybody, nations have pavilions, so, and each is represented. But then there's also one curated exhibition, which is done, in this case, by Massimiliano Gioni. And he's really spaced it out. He's made it very elegant. And he's brought in people who weren't usually considered artists, you know, people who are outsider artists, people with mental problems, people who are slightly outside the normal path of art. But above all, he's made it look absolutely beautiful. But the talk of the town, I regret to say, is the parties. I mean, there are about five parties going on every single night, not to mention the inaugurations, the politicians. Caroline of Monaco is here, Leonardo DiCaprio. There's an Emirati prince with his yacht moored off one of the down by the Stazione Marittima, where the great cruise ships come in. And so people are rushing around like maniacs and actually not looking terribly happy because they can't be at all the parties simultaneously.
Well, Anna, if you need a plus one to any of these events, just give me a shout. I'm more than happy to tag along. You mentioned there are 88 different countries with exhibitions, some of them including, you know, the Bahamas have blocks of ice that are there. The Vatican has a beating heart, a heartbeat. Does the Venice Biennale still capture the imagination of your average art goer?
Absolutely, because this curious formula of nations means that everybody's there actually in theory as an equal. So you can go and see the pavilion of Bosnia. Now, Bosnian artists don't usually get much for looking on the international scene, but sometimes they turn up something interesting, you know. And so everybody's in there with a chance. It's like taking part in a race where there are no handicaps. And so there's this slightly competitive thing between nations, and also this touching thing that Lebanon, which is, you know, may well be engulfed in this ghastly Syrian conflict. Little Lebanon is put on a very good show and had a party and a lot of very moving speeches before it sort of got launched. So everybody, the history of each country presented here, Tuvalu, the little place in the South Pacific that's going to be completely inundated when the water rises. Tuvalu is represented for the first time with, indeed, an exhibition about sea level rise.
And there have been a few criticisms that this is slightly too slick. I mean, we've seen some wonderful sort of adjustments made by Massimiliano Gottioni, but do you think that this is over-PR'd this year?
Oh, I mean, this is a PR feast. I mean, the PR people are rushing around trying to bag anybody of any note, go to this or that, and it's being overexploited. It's also sort of, you know, moment for the dealers are here as well, but trying to sort of sort out deals which will then be carried out in Basel at the fair next week, you know. This is not a completely pure event by any means. But I mean, what can one say? Venice is alive at the moment, and it's full of what people they say Venice used to be full of, intellectuals and smart people, which it isn't for the rest of the year.
Anna Summers Cox there from the art newspaper in Venice. Many thanks for your time, and do let me know if you need that plus one. But as we heard, many of the countries, 88 countries participating in this year's Biennale, one of them getting lots of attention is the country Iraq. Joining us now is Jonathan Watkins. He's the curator of the Iraq Pavilion and director of Birmingham's Icon Gallery. Jonathan, many thanks for coming on Midori House. Iraq getting a lot of attention at this year's event.
Yeah, I know. We're thrilled. I mean, we were talking earlier about countries that don't normally get a look in, and certainly Iraq is one of those.
Would you mind telling us how you set about really curating this pavilion? I mean, the art scene in Iraq has been incredibly vibrant, but it's obviously struggled in recent years. I wondered where you found your artists and how you went about doing that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's the art scene in Iraq, and that's something that we stress. For the first time, for a long time in the Biennale, there are artists here who are living and working in Iraq rather than Iraqi artists who are made in Berlin or New York or London or wherever. And so it was a question of going there a number of times and hearing things on the grapevine, going from artist to artist, because there certainly is no go-to curator in Iraq. There's no one that I can call up when I'm in Baghdad and say, you know, tell me about the video artist that I must see in Basra. It's very raw material that we're looking at here.
And Jonathan, how difficult of a challenge do you think it will be for you and this exhibition to really change people's perceptions of what they might think Iraq is like?
Well, this exhibition certainly doesn't confirm expectations of such an exhibition. I mean, the idea of the Middle East, of this region being one of conflict, isn't overtly conveyed by this show. These are people who are more concerned to communicate what it is like to be there, you know, day in, day out. So they're focusing less on geopolitics, less on checkpoints and car bombs, and more on things that you know, really preoccupy them in the face of great difficulty. So ecology, infrastructure, human relationships. I mean, there's a kind of human drama that's in this show, and not so much weaponry and gore.
Jonathan Watkins there, the curator of the Iraq Pavilion and director of Birmingham's Icon Gallery. Many thanks for coming on Midori House, and good luck with the rest of the festival. And before that, we heard from Anna Summers Cox of the Art newspaper. We'll be right back. Sophie, I don't know if Anna's going to give me that.
I don't. Despite two shameless plugs, I don't know if your invitation will be forthcoming.
Fingers crossed. I'm free this weekend.
I can see
Anna,
you on a yacht.
If you're listening.
That Emirati prince will be dropping a note.
Moving on from Venice, Germany, the industrial powerhouse renowned for its engineering and efficiency, is where we're going to head to next now to discuss the latest development in the ongoing saga that is Berlin's under construction Brandenburg Airport.
Once dubbed Europe's most modern airport by its management, the opening has been pushed back four times already due to hundreds of design errors and construction defects. But now, in a coup for its new CEO, talks abound that a staggered opening will start this autumn, with budget airline EasyJet moving in. Joining us to help fathom the latest twist in the turn of Berlin's ill-fated airport is Andrew Bulkley, Monocle contributor. Now, Andrew, how seriously do we take this speculation? We've heard so many times that Brandenburg might be opening. Are you hopeful?
I think you could sort of take this somewhat positively. I'm cautiously optimistic. All these other opening times were under previous managers who weren't very good at managing, and Maydorn, he has a track record of getting things open, getting them done, not necessarily the way the architect wanted them or the way the original planning was supposed to happen, but he gets it done. So I think it's probably possible. There's a lot that has to be investigated about which airlines would go there, how much it would cost. But, you know, the German traffic ministry said, yeah, no, these plans, we're actually considering them, and we have to look at them seriously. So I think it might happen. And you also have to know, this sounds revolutionary that the new airport is opening. It's not really a new airport. What they're doing is expanding an existing airport. So if some airlines move there in the fall, which is the speculation, it's not as if they're going to a completely new airport. They would just turn right where they previously turned left after landing.
So if this Northern Pier terminal opens later this fall, and indeed EasyJet are the first airline to actually use it, how are other airlines reacting to this news? I'm sure Lufthansa must be quite angry at the prospect of EasyJet getting the premier slot, so to speak.
Yeah, this is kind of a problem. You know, this is a gigantic public construction project. That means there's lots of tax money going there. There's lots of subsidies. There's help for the airlines when they move from the government. And if suddenly Berlin, the city-state of Berlin, is helping EasyJet, giving them money that might give them a financial advantage, then, of course, Lufthansa, Air Berlin, all these airlines are going to run to the EU and say, hey, that's an unfair subsidy, that's illegal. And so this is one of the things that Maydorn, the CEO of the airport, he's going to have to look at and make sure that if EasyJet does go over there, they're not getting some advantage from it. And this Northern Pier, it has to be said, the reason this could open early is because this thing is just basically a cow shed. This is the terminal for discount airlines. There's no moving walkways in there. There aren't even signs. To save money, they just painted all the directions right on the wall. So this thing, it's not really like a luxury terminal. It's just kind of a barn. And so it would be easy to move into early, but the rest of the airport is still a mess.
But, I mean, as you say, is this really the final blow for the reputation of this airport? If, as you say, it's sort of a barn situation, you know, EasyJet really sounds like the only airline that would be willing to take such a construction. And what we hoped for was this absolutely slick, modern airport.
The really funny thing, when you fly out of Berlin, there's a big sign that says the airport of the future, and it shows this airport, and I think, yeah, that's the future, it's not the present. When is this actually going to happen, you know? Yeah, that's just it. It's supposed to be this great, beautiful airport, and in the end, you're just ending up going through a barn here with EasyJet. And I kind of started wondering last night if this just isn't a gigantic publicity coup for EasyJet, because look how many times we've said their names in this report. You know, this is kind of like when Ryanair said they were going to start charging to use the bathroom. In the end, this might not happen because it's just impractical and too expensive. Why run two airports at the same site when you've already got one fully functioning? So I do wonder if this just isn't something that EasyJet thought, hey, let's leak this and see how much publicity we can get.
And Andrew, some more bad news coming out of the airport as well. It was emerged that it's become Germany's most expensive building site, with 24-hour lighting and air conditioning systems that have driven up costs to $32 million a month. What can, if anything, the management actually do in order to try to reverse some of this bad press and get Berliners maybe to fall back in love with it?
Well, I think this is part of it. I think this is something where Maydorn said, we've got to get people attached to this airport, and maybe if we get them flying through it already. It's worse than that. You know, there's a subway system that goes out there, and subways are constructed to have trains running on them. And if there's no trains running on them, they deteriorate. So there's a subway out there running. There's a driver driving the subway back and forth every day with nobody in it. There's all kinds of things going on out there that cost money, and I'm sure Maydorn, who comes from the private sector, is thinking we've got to start getting some kind of cash flow on these things, and one way would be to have partial service. But it just, you know, there's no security in this North Pier, there's no baggage facilities. They would have to install all of this stuff provisionally, so you're having temporary solutions of what's supposed to be a permanent solution.
Well, indeed, it does sound like quite the mess. Andrew Bulkley, their financial journalist and European correspondent for The Deal magazine.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be heading north. To North Africa, rather, to discuss Al-Qaeda's human resources problem. We'll review this morning's British front pages and we'll head to Shanghai. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
An American soldier accused of killing 16 Afghan civilians has agreed to plead guilty in return for avoiding the death penalty. Robert Bales could still be sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole by a military court hearing. But there's been an angry reaction to the news from the relatives of the Afghans he killed. The US State Department's warned Hezbollah to get its fighters out of Syria amid reports that thousands are fighting against rebel forces in the country. It's estimated up to 7,000 have travelled from Lebanon. Meanwhile, the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, has said that the first shipment of a Russian anti-aircraft missile system has now arrived in the country. A man's been charged with the murder of a British soldier who was killed last week on a street in London. Michael Adebowale is due to appear before a court later accused of the killing of Lee Rigby. Health officials have warned that the novel coronavirus now poses a threat to the entire world. There have been fewer than 50 confirmed human cases so far, but more than half of them have been fatal. And the mayor of New York has said he will not end his campaign for tougher gun control laws after police confirmed ricin was present in two letters sent to him. The poison is 1,000 times more toxic than cyanide. The letters attacked Michael Bloomberg's gun control campaign. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. You're back with the Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove and Phil Hahn. This week, The Urbanist is looking at privacy in the city, from a man who's tried to avoid the increasing amount of CCTV in Britain to the app in Adelaide that documents your favourite quiet places. Andrew Tutt will be investigating how to find a bit of peace from the dense social space.
But in this preview, we're heading to Shanghai. China is home to 1.3 billion people and its many megacities are densely packed, congested places. So getting your hands on a bit of private space is not only a sought after, it comes at a premium. Like much of the country, Shanghai's developers are seeing the dollar signs. And so up go the tower blocks of private apartments and down come the city's traditional lane houses, or lielongs.
These alley communities offer little privacy. Residents share kitchens, bathrooms, but also, importantly, they gossip. Talk to each other. For many, they provide a crucial social function. But still, not everyone is sad to see them go. Ruth Morris filed this report on life in the lane.
If you're in Shanghai and you hear people playing mahjong outside your window, there's a good chance you're in a lane house. The lane is like a neighborhood living room. On muggy nights, men and women sit outside in their pajamas and eat watermelon seeds. In this lane, a group of women do their morning calisthenics together. The lane is also where people wash their vegetables and hang their laundry. That's because inside, it's pretty cramped.
So that one should be the first family, and then here...
I visited a lane house with Dean. His friend Sabrina lives here. We walked through a communal kitchen and up an unlit stairwell. It's unclear where one person's home ends and another begins.
Yeah. Hello. Hi, Sabrina. Nice to meet you.
Sabrina's Chinese name is Yao Jia. She's a real estate agent, and she's lived in this building for 10 years. She loves it here. She's especially pleased with the renovations to her one-room flat.
Patio. The landlord changed it into the bathroom and a laundry area. And most of the people, family, live in the land house. Probably they will not be so lucky to have a separate their own kitchen and a bathroom.
She's also happy because she recently found a turtle, which is good for feng shui. Dean also has turtles.
One day when I get into a taxi and I find this one.
You found a turtle in a taxi?
Yes.
Sabrina says the neighbors here, they know everything about her. And she's fine with that.
Everybody know each other. How many person in your family, what they do, what is their salary. Old person talk about their children, young children, whether they get married or not. Or if their daughter is very old age, not yet get married, they ask other people to help.
Sabrina likes the community spirit. She's going to have a baby in less than 3 months, and she's counting on her neighbors for support and free childcare. Her friend Dean has a different take.
sometimes a little bit noisy, and sometimes no privacy, and sometimes you can see rats. Yeah, and sometimes when it's rainy, it will be leaky. So you live with trouble. If you live there, you live with troubles.
Dean is a language teacher. His Chinese name is Wang Chen. He moved out of a lane house 6 months ago. The lack of privacy was a bit much, and the building was run down and crowded. Three families shared one bathroom. He could hear his neighbor snoring through the floorboards. He prefers what he calls a friendly distance between tenants. And like many of Chinese young professionals, he found it in a downtown high-rise. He explains why so many of these old lane houses have been knocked down. He says for many, old equals bad.
We have the Cultural Revolution. For a very long time, we think the old equals bad. The old equals, you know, out of date. The old equals poorer. But gradually, they realize this kind of building, they have a brand. A brand which means they should be maintained and they should be protected.
Using the public toilet was no fun. I had to walk a good 4 or 5 minutes down the lane to use the public facilities, and there's no dividers.
Michael Meyer writes about changing communities in China. For his first book, The Last Days of Old Beijing, he lived for 3 years in Beijing's version of traditional housing, the Hutong Courtyard House. He rented two tiny rooms in a courtyard he shared with seven other people. On the first day, an elderly neighbor approached him with the ground rules.
And she said, public is public, private is private. I said, okay. She said, repeat it. I said, okay, public is public, private is private. The next morning at 5 o'clock, she walked in. We didn't have locks on our door. She opened my front door, came in with her cigarette ash, you know, dangling, with a bowl of steaming dumplings, and came to my bed and banged on it and called me lazy worm. That is living in a courtyard. Everything is public.
Meyer had no hot water, no indoor plumbing, and no heat. This is Beijing, where it snows in the winter. He says most people living in Hutongs are not sentimental about the building's historical value.
What they care most about is that dense social network that allows them, within 5 minutes, to basically get everything they need, except maybe open-heart surgery.
Thousands of Hutong homes have been destroyed as China modernizes. Meyer says the transition from traditional housing to suburban high-rise is especially disorienting for the elderly. They lose their friends, their history, and their role. And the new high-rises can be bleak, with no commercial spaces, no trees or playgrounds. Meyer says he often meets with urban planners and officials who ask themselves, can planning actually build a community? He tells them, the Chinese invented this, actually. It's called a hutong, and now they can't wait to tear these things down. Back in Shanghai, a man walks through a lane playing a public service announcement over a portable loudspeaker. It says, avoid house fires and theft. Some wealthy Chinese and expats have been renovating entire lane homes here. Sabrina is happy to see them preserved.
When Shanghai started to developed, a lot of people, they do agree that we need high speed of development. But now, you people started to see some problems of going too fast. Nowadays, more and more people wanted to see we develop, but more slower down.
Dean mostly wants people to have the option of moving into safer, less crowded quarters. When he walks past the more squalid lane houses, he worries about the people living inside. He says Shanghai keeps growing and growing, like his pet turtles. He buys them a bigger tub, and then they grow some more. He sees the skyline getting taller and taller, and he wonders if Shanghai's residents will ever have enough space. For Monocle in Shanghai, I'm Ruth Morris.
You know what, Sophie? I could totally picture you living in one of these Lilongs with a bathtub full of turtles, just caring for those turtles until they grow old.
And chit-chatting with neighbors.
Yeah. Would you like that?
I would, actually. I think it sounds like a really wonderful piece of old heritage.
I don't know about the turtles, though.
No, they're good for feng shui, though.
Apparently, yeah. Well, that is just a little slice of what is to come on this week's Urbanist, which is all focused on privacy this week. And, of course, you can catch the full episode tonight at 1900 hours London time right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with an update from our woman in Mali.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
It's 15:40 in Shanghai, 8:40 here in London, and 7:40 in Bamako, which is where we head now.
Joining us on the line is our correspondent there, Alex Duval-Smith. Alex, many thanks for coming on the program. It is lovely to speak to you. You've got an interesting story here regarding an exclusive letter that's just been obtained by the Associated Press. What can you tell us about this?
Indeed, the Associated Press, like many, has had journalists milling about in Timbuktu, and their journalists found a letter essentially addressed to one of the leaders of Al-Qaeda. And it sort of raises some interesting points which we don't really associate with terrorists as usual, which is their problems with basically personnel, human resources problems getting terrorists to obey orders, problems with getting terrorists to turn up for meetings, problems with getting terrorists to stage big enough attacks. For example, this letter is addressed to Mokhtar Belmokhtar, who's one of the notorious Al-Qaeda terrorists in the desert here in Mali, and he's actually criticized by the leadership for being unwilling to stage a large attack. And shortly after this letter, which is dated from October, and goes back quite a long way, but shortly after this letter, he apparently left Al-Qaeda and set up his own organization called the Signatories in Blood, which we've heard of since, and claimed responsibility for the In Amenas attack on the gas installation in Algeria. But it's just an interesting sort of insight into how even terrorist organizations have problems with their staff.
Alex, it also does make them look rather ridiculous. I mean, some of these complaints that he didn't answer his phone, he failed to turn in his expense reports and ignored, orders. But really, the phone aspect of things and these sort of small administrative queries they had just make Al-Qaeda look a little bit farcical, really, rather than this fearsome terrorist cell.
Well, it does very much so, at least it rather makes it look like the rest of us, if you know what I mean, rather than the fearsome organisation that we've perhaps built it up to be. It does little more than sort of cast a light of real life on this organisation. But we've heard in the past of Al-Qaeda operatives, for example, clashing with other members of the organisation, having conflicts over marriages and relationships. In fact, Belmokhtar himself, just to come back to him, he has now essentially left Al-Qaeda. And how did he do it? He did it by marrying the daughter of Umar Hamada, who is the leader of Mujahid. Mujahid being the organization which now appears to be dominant in the region and which claimed responsibility for the attack last week on the French uranium mine in Niger. So, you have intermarriage, you have a whole power structure also functioning through marriages and relationships, human relationships, which is perhaps something we also forget.
I think I can sense a Hollywood movie coming along with that plot line. Sounds,
maybe a comedy.
Yeah, maybe a comedy. But Alex, there's another story which ties in nicely with this, though, is the discovery in the sands of northern Mali.
Oh, yes. Now, this really is something from a comedy. Christophe Guillotot, French MP and head of the France's Defence Select Committee, revealed in the National Assembly that papers from the French Unemployment Office had been found in the Mali desert.
So what we're finding there is essentially benefit claims being used back in France by terrorists based in Mali. I can't imagine this has gone down very well at all in France, considering the austerity that it's undergoing at the moment.
Precisely. And Guillotot, he's a right-wing, a UMP MP, so he's used it very much against François Hollande. It probably wouldn't have become known if it hadn't been announced by him in Parliament. The papers were found by the French army when they arrested one of two Franco-Malian terrorists earlier this year, and it sort of gradually leaked out. But yes, they are unemployment claim forms, benefit claim forms. So if you think about it, that means France is paying the salaries of terrorists who are firing at French soldiers who are being paid by the French taxpayer.
And Alex, let's move on there from North Africa to Mauritania, precisely. Opposition activists there staging a relatively small but quite brave demonstration in the capital.
Absolutely, and a very telling one. The opposition in Mauritania can't really say very much, do very much very often. It's a very repressive state. It's a state where slavery is still legalized, Mauritania. So, and any criticism of the state is harshly reprimanded. But nevertheless, the coordination of the democratic opposition did stage a sit-in demonstration this week on Monday in Nouakchott, the capital, against the president, against Mahamadou Abdelaziz, and claiming that Mauritania has become a narco state, claiming that the president must resign because he's too tied in with international drug smuggling leagues, such as cocaine smugglers from South America, who are now bringing cocaine through this part of West Africa for onward transport to Europe. We know about planes, both in Mali and Mauritania, that have arrived laden with cocaine, and essentially it's very clear that that requires complicity from the authorities, from the army, and in Mauritania, the opposition is claiming that that complicity goes right up to the top, right up to the president, who must now resign. A very brave demonstration.
Well, Alex, as ever, fantastic to speak to you. That was Alex Duval-Smith, our woman in Mali.
I really do think there's some potential in perhaps a Hollywood film on those first two stories, don't you?
Who would you cast, though?
As Muqtada al-Muqtada.
Yeah. You'd have to be almost endearing.
I don't know if I'd want to say that on air.
No, okay.
I don't want to get anyone. I don't want to get in trouble.
Okay, let's leave that.
Let's just leave that out there.
Yeah, scribble it down in your little secret
notebook.
I'll
send
notebook.
It to you during the song, if that's okay. because in a moment, we're going to be looking at the British front pages in just a quick moment with a very talented man, our news editor, Tom Edwards.
But before all that, a great song here from Angus and Julia Stone. This is Big Jet Plane.
That's the perfect song if you're just, you know, heading into Heathrow, about to board that plane, going onto some Caribbean island somewhere. That's my dream.
Is this a fantasy narrative?
Fantasy. but instead, it was not me. It was Angus and Julia Stone there with Big Jet Plane.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Sophie Grove, and Phil Hahn. Joining us now for a run-through of the British papers is news editor Tom Edwards. Welcome back to the studio, Tom.
Hi, Sophie.
Tom, you're going on a jet plane soon, aren't you? You're heading off to the States, aren't you, with Monocle?
That's right.
Do you want to give us a little sneak peek, perhaps?
Keen-eyed listeners, does that make sense, will know that we're bringing some Monocle Daily shows next week from the Pacific Northwest.
Exciting.
So we'll be in Vancouver, Seattle, and Portland next week.
That's exciting.
Indeed.
Well, that, of course, is happening in the northeastern United States. Northwest United States. My geography is
Come on, Phil. Get it right.
But let's start with a man that everyone loves to smile with, perhaps. Boris Johnson, the mayor of London.
That's right. He's fathered a love child, so today's Independent.
And it's not you, is it?
And had three affairs, but the British public still loves him. This is a new poll in the Indy today that Nigel Morris is writing about. Three in four voters entirely unfazed by Boris's, as they describe it, antics. Ask the question, the revelation that Boris has fathered a child outside his marriage make it less likely you would vote for him in a general election. Only 15% agree with that. 76% do not agree.
It's very curious, isn't it? Because the British public are quite moral in some respects. And it really does sort of, he seems to be the great exception. The fact that you can make people laugh really is the get out of jail free card for almost every misdemeanor.
I was going to say, it all seems to depend on the elan with which you commit your various crimes. And if you do it with a comedy haircut and a smile on your face, possibly on board a bicycle, then it's not going to be a problem.
And, you know, he is the mayor of London, but he truly is a national figure. And, you know, some could even argue that he is quite well known on the international stage as well. Just yesterday, David Cameron's former spin doctor, Andy Coulson, came out with comments where he actually said that Boris Johnson was, quote, desperate to take the top job there at number 10. Do you see that as a real prospect of happening? I know lots of people have rumors about him wanting to take over.
I mean, indisputably, that's what he wants to do. If you talk to his biographers, for example, people who've known him well throughout his career, this is a man of just almost unbelievable ambition. And he has created this persona for himself. A lot of people say, oh, he's too much of a sort of, you know, he plays the fool and, you know, he's not serious enough to be a politician. But you misjudge him at your peril, people who know him well say. He clearly does. As Andy Coulson supposedly said, he didn't want to challenge Cameron. He's just waiting for him to, quote, fail miserably and then just sort of step into the breach afterwards. So, no, there's no question that's what he wants. And personally, I fear he has a reasonably good chance of doing it, which is a sobering prospect for us all.
It is very, very much. Now, let's move on to another story in the UK papers. I can see you clutching The Guardian there. There are some rather interesting portraits in The Guardian this morning. They're sort of mock-ups, really, of some past sailors.
This is right. So the Mary Rose, which our keen followers of history will know, was Henry VIII's flagship, sank in the 16th century in the Solent, just down in the Channel. It was recovered in the 1970s, right the way through to the 1990s. There's now a new museum, which is opening tomorrow. And as part of the exhibit, they've taken some of the sort of bones that they found from these sailors on board and sort of given them new life, recreated what they would have actually looked like. So we've got the bosun, the cook, an archer, and they've managed to piece these things together by looking at sort of deformities in the skeleton. So this archer, for example, was 5'10" tall. Now that's a giant by 16th century standards, but he had a twisted spine, and he had a groove on the inside of one of his right-hand fingers, which is apparently characteristic. Our listeners can't see this, but I'm making exaggerated bow-firing gestures.
Very impressive.
But what do you think of him? That's him there, our archer friend.
He's quite handsome.
Shoulder-length hair, rugged good looks, I would say.
In fact, he actually looks like he should be in a sort of West London indie band.
He does. They do look rather like that, actually, don't they? Men of the Mary Rose.
They do.
It could be a band.
They're almost a little bit too real.
I think the bosun, however, would have to be the manager. He wouldn't be allowed on stage. He looks a bit more grizzled.
He's more like an old rocker.
Exactly. In his early 40s, he looks like he's given probably 10 years more than that. Like many of his shipmates, he had extremely poor teeth. He did manual work when he was younger, but he was found with a whistle with which he used to give instructions to his crewmates.
And another story about the sea, the high seas. This fascinating story, about a bluefin tuna. This amazing photo of it
This is in the Times, the London Times. A giant tuna caught off Torquay. It could be worth as much as £500,000. But it was caught just yards from the Devon coast. They don't normally stray that far. And it was brought ashore by these delighted fishermen who were thinking, wow, our luck's in. Probably thinking back to the sale of a big bluefin tuna in Tokyo for £1 million in January, it was immediately confiscated by government officials just before it was due to go to auction. The Marine Management Organisation, which is part of DEFRA, reminding the fishermen that it's critically endangered and illegal to catch or sell in Britain.
So even though it was dead?
Well, apparently it was floundering on the rocks. So I don't know whether they should have, you know, taken it back out to sea and rehabilitated it. I don't know what they were supposed to do.
So what's going to happen with it?
Well, do you know what? I'm not sure. It's just it's literally and metaphorically on ice, Phil. So we'll have to keep an eye. But it was 4'6", which is, I mean, and there's a picture of it there. It looks kind of surprised, which I guess you would be if you'd just been fished out of the drink. But apparently only 7 Mediterranean countries are allowed to catch bluefin tuna in Europe. The season's very limited. In UK, we import a great deal, almost 100,000 tonnes of the fish, worth nearly £3 million. But we only bring in about £25,000 worth of longfin tuna, which is albacore, as you would know it.
Oh, interesting.
I've never had bluefin tuna.
Oh, it's well worth checking out.
I want to save the planet for future generations, not
Phil. You can't worry about that kind of thing. You need to profit while you still can.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Tom's news editor, Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards, there with a look through the British front pages. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producers, Barbara Feeney and Annabelle Bly. Our researcher today was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Up next, after the news, is Culture with Robert Bound. Andrew Tuck and myself will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Sophie Grove.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.